In her book, Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America from the Courtroom to the Kill Zones, Connie Rice, one of America's most prominent and successful civil rights litigators, who also happens to be the second cousin of former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, illuminates the origin and inspiration for her life's work. Rice's race for excellence began at home. Her father broke racial barriers as a U.S. Air Force major, and her mother, a teacher, imbued a passion for learning and culture into Connie and her brothers, a zeal equal parts vigor and pride. The name of the book is Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America, From the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. Connie Rice, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
What brought you to tell your story, to write about the many trials and tribulations that you have had and lived?
Well, so I was pushed into doing this by a couple of people who said, "Where's your book?" But the real reason I wanted to do it is that as somebody who tries to give the folks at the bottom the tools they need to pull themselves up, I was noticing my clients were getting more and more erased. They're not counted in the unemployment statistics. They're counted for the prison beds, but not for jobs. They're, you know, if they're homeless, they're swept under and sort of ethnically cleansed from Skid Rows. And I said, you know what, we've done a war on the poor, and somebody in the upper middle class has got to shine a light on it, aside from Barbara Ehrenreich. So I went to lunch with a journalist, and I was trying to get this journalist to focus on my clients, and she said, the journalist looked at me, she says, "Oh, but Connie, that's not interesting. Poverty is boring. I want to know why, you know, you didn't stay married," or some silly nonsense like that. And it just screamed in my ears, poverty is boring. Well, let me tell you something. If you're poor, it ain't boring. And we need to understand. And the message of this book is, it's not just interesting stories of fascinating people who struggle every day and triumph. It is that. But the main message of this book is why we ought to care, why we in the middle class have to understand our destiny is tied to the folks in invisible America at the bottom of the well, and that if we allow the kids from these echelons of society to grow up poor, die young, create a deadly gang culture and other bad cultures. You want to know something? That stuff isn't going to stay contained in the ghetto and the barrio and the hollers of Appalachia. That stuff will eventually leave the kill zones and come right back at us in the middle class zones.
It's fascinating because we often simply put it in the franchised and the disenfranchised, but then there are those who are just in the ether who are none of the above.
That's right, and within any cohort, I don't mean to get techie on you, but where you sit in society is relative, and so even in the middle class, there are all kinds of different types of middle class. Well, there are all kinds of different poor, and you know, I'm not talking about the functional working poor. I'm not talking about the immigrant poor necessarily, except when they become victims of the gang violence in the kill zones and the hot zones and the gang zones in L.A. I am talking about the very bottom of the last 10th percentile. And these are folks who haven't had a job in five generations. You know, when William Julius Wilson wrote the book When Work Disappears, when Michelle Alexander wrote her great book, The New Jim Crow, about how our mass incarceration, where we're locking up 60% of the men in these poor areas. Well, you know, I'm a feminist, but even a feminist knows that if you take the men out of a community, that community will die. The kids will go off the rails. And so a lot of our policies that we do just to make ourselves think that we're safer and that condemn their communities to a whole bunch of stupid stuff like mass incarceration, schools that don't work, and so forth, we leave them in these hot zones, and then we wonder why when they come to our neighborhoods, the police and General McChrystal and others are warning on the back of my book. I mean, you got to admit, what civil rights lawyer would get General McChrystal and Chief Bratton and Condi Rice
right.
to endorse her book? It's because they understand what happens if you leave kids in chronic deprivation. Guess what? You can't contain it. You can't keep it in the ghetto. It ends up coming back at us.
I want to go back to, before we get into the meat of this issue, I do want to go back to what the journalist told you, that poverty is boring. And where do we get that notion? Where does that come from?
Oh, you know, I'm the last person, because I'm so clueless. I really am socially clueless. I don't understand the cult of celebrity. I don't understand why, you know, kids sleep out on the sidewalk all day to look at somebody who did something bad on television during the Super Bowl. I don't get our cult of celebrity, our absolute fascination with fame, and it's gone a little too far. It's gone a little too far. And so what we end up doing is we're entertaining ourselves to death. If it's a serious topic and you're presenting serious material, nobody wants to hear it because you're not entertaining, because you're not making people feel good. You're asking them to think. You're asking them to act in a way that they're going to feel like diminishes their comfort, and you're asking them to do it so that they won't face a bigger danger down the road. Well, guess what? The cops and the military get what I'm talking about, but the journalist, she was there thinking, oh, well, maybe I can get her to talk about her cousin, or right, get her to talk about Harry Belafonte, with whom I work. You know, she was thinking entertainment tonight. I'm trying to think of Fareed Zakaria and some serious frontline television.
Your work with LA gang members, at what point did you realize that you could make a difference in that world, that there could be a partnership and that you could actually make a difference in their lives?
Well, I did have to go down there, because you can't learn what's going on in Appalachia or the Native Alaskan reservations or the barrios or the kill zones in the ghetto. You can't learn that stuff sitting at a desk being a lawyer, and you can't learn it by being in court. And so what I decided after the Rodney King riots in 92 was that, look, I'm at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We're great lawyers. We win our cases, but then we look up and we see that our clients were losing their lives. And I said, I got to go into these zones. I have to understand why my clients, and I'm winning the cases that they asked me to bring, but their children are losing their futures. Their children are losing their lives. I said, I need to understand more, because that's not success. Yeah, we're winning, but if your client's losing, you got to figure out a new game. So we needed to start over. And after the riots, I realized, you know, you're not going to get this stuff sitting in a courtroom or sitting in an office downtown. I was going to have to hit the streets. I was going to have to learn what people really faced. And so that's how I started, right after the riots. And I stumbled. You can't imagine how stupid I was. I go straight from federal court. I'm dressed up in a St. John suit and more pearls than Barbara Bush and Ferragamo pumps. And I go down to the ghetto to the black housing projects. And I look like E.T. You know, I look like something that's landed off a spaceship. Well, bottom line is the women of Jordan Downs Housing Project, which at the time was one of the African-American-dominated housing projects, they said to me, the only thing you can do, is after they cussed me out royally, for basically abandoning them. They said, you middle-class Negroes have abandoned us. We have to put our children to bed in bathtubs at night because the bullets come through the drywall. We have to put our older children to bed on the floor because if they sleep in a bed, three of them have already died. We left them in a war zone, a crack war zone. And these women stood up, cussed me and another lawyer out royally, and basically said, go help our men. They've hammered out a truce. Help them carry it out, because we have to get the violence reduced. We can't do anything when bullets are coming through the walls at night. So I found out where they were. They were in a trailer behind the local middle school, and in this ridiculous get-up with a briefcase, I go knock on the door, and they open the door, and it's this trailer full of Grape Street Crips and Blood Bounty Hunters, and they have the colors of their flags wrapped around their heads and biceps, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, where am I? But they were negotiating how to carry out the big truce that they had already done. And I stupidly stand at the door and say, hi, my name is Connie Rice. I'm a lawyer with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I think I left off NAACP because those letters didn't do very well in that part of town. Mm-hmm. And then I'm a lawyer with LDF. And they slammed the door in my face. And then a few minutes later, they opened it up, and they asked me for something pretty astonishing. They said, you a lawyer? I said, yeah. They said, can you get us that agreement between the Jews and the Arabs? And I stupidly said, oh, you mean the Egyptian-Sinai Peace Accord? Mm. I said, yeah, that one. Can you bring us that one? I said, yeah, I can get you a copy of that. They said, good, because if the Jews and the Arabs can get along, we can follow their example and do it ourselves.
Mm.
And that was the beginning of my journey in the gangland. I learned it from ex-gangsters and current gangsters, and these are the black gangs. These are not the Armenian gangs or the Latino gangs. I was learning the African-American gangland, and because if you don't understand the biggest threat to your clients, you can't really help your clients.
And you go into a system where you think of the good guys and the bad guys, and you would hope and you would think that the police department would be part of the good guys, that they would be trying to make a safer city and would be one that would be looking for peace in the streets of that particular municipality. But here is a department that you write about that has gone through great transformation, but is a department that was largely seen as corrupt, a department that had huge issues within it. And over two decades, you were able to come into the system and make changes there as well.
Well, in a way, yes. I think timing, one of life's secrets, of course, is timing. And had I come to L.A. 30 years ago, I'd have had nothing but war as a way of communicating with them. And so for the first 15 years of my arrival in L.A., it was war. We woke up every day trying to figure out how to sue LAPD and the L.A. County Sheriffs, because the police were an extremely negative and destructive and emasculating force in poor minority communities. They would prone everybody out. They were disrespectful. A few were openly racist. They saw their job as targeting poor communities, not protecting them, but targeting them. And so outside of the South, I had never seen an African-American community have such virulent, palpable hate for an institution like African-Americans in L.A. had for LAPD. And it was because LAPD was so gratuitously humiliating, so gratuitously emasculating, and they ended up creating a real wall of hatred against themselves. And so we didn't have any choice but to sue. So we had the 10, 15 years of war. But out of some of those cases, Joe, what I ended up discovering was that there were good cops in there. They couldn't emerge because the mean cops were in charge. And the good cops were as afraid of the mean guard in LAPD as the community was. And so what I would find is that the good cops, I called them the Blue Angels, they would either call me from their desks, or for the African-American officers who helped us, they would go to a payphone and they would put coins in the payphone and call my office, and then they would whisper into the phone a warning about what Graveyard Shift was doing in Hollenbeck or what Graveyard Shift was doing in Jordan Downs, and they would give us warnings. And then later on, we had Deputy Chief Brewer, Jess Brewer, and people like Homer Broom, and some of the higher-ranking African-American command staff decided, you know what, we've had enough. We're tired of LAPD refusing to promote black officers. We're tired of them telling us we can't do narcotics details. It wasn't but 5 years before I came on that black officers were not allowed to even patrol with white officers because the old guard in the LAPD did not want a black officer being able to give a white officer orders. So we were up against, it wasn't quite in the heat of the night, but, you know, we were up against a very powerful paramilitary police force, and lawsuits started our relationship when I arrived. But you had had people suing and fighting LAPD for over 50 years before I got here. And it was that 70-year battle that if you really want the details, you read Joe Dominic's book, To Protect and Serve. But at the end of that 70 years, Joe, I could see an opening. I could see openings because we turned at the suggestion of Chief Brewer. He said, look, Connie, you guys are great lawyers. You're going to win every case, but you're not going to touch LAPD because LAPD doesn't pay any attention to what courts say. You can get all the consent decrees you want. If you don't represent police, you're never going to have the credibility that you need. So we got away from representing just regular, you know, Jane and Joe Doe, who had suffered at the hands of LAPD. We started representing cops. I called it the Serpico practice. Mm. And once you start representing cops, you really get the inside picture. And you start to become fluent in their culture and their cues. And you start to understand a little bit why they behave the way they do. And so when I started that, I saw openings to become fluent in their customs and their cues, their culture. And I could talk to them in a way that said, look, what do you need to feel safe enough to stop terrorizing the community? And once I phrased it that way, they opened up. So it's a fascinating story about how war can often blind both sides, but that when you get that opening and you have a few people from both sides willing to take some chances, you can turn the ship around. You can end the war, and you can actually understand you both really want the same thing. I mean, when Chief Bratton came, and he was the beginning of the end of the old Imperial LAPD, where they just basically acted with impunity. Abuse of force was the kind of corruption that LAPD did, particularly mm-hmm. in the poor communities. And they never paid a price because they had the politicians so cow. The politicians would just pay the judgments. There was one year LAPD ended up causing the city to pay out $27 million. $27 million in judgments, cases of people saying they beat me, they hogtied me, they abused me illegally. So that's how we started on a new path. And after a while, after Chief Bratton came in, and we had to fight to get him into LAPD as an outsider, that began to be the beginning of the end of LAPD's era of impunity, era of arrogant force. And lo and behold, 15 years later, we're fast allies now, at least at the top. I'm not going to say everything has changed in the graveyard shift in the poorest areas. No. But the leadership has definitely transformed.
For every step forward, the old saying goes, you take a few steps back. Was there concern on your part that by taking on cases of police officers, that you would lose some of the ground that you gained with the gang members that you were working with as well?
Yeah, that was a concern, but I had to explain to Bo Taylor and to Fred Williams, they said, look, you're going to see me talking to the more reasonable cops. I've got to, because they're our ticket to changing LAPD. They're our ticket to backing gang intervention, former gangsters who stop the next retaliation shootings and protect the ERs. At the time, they were not allowed to operate. The cops saw them as a threat, and so they'd go after gang intervention. My job was to make gang intervention viewed by cops as an asset to law enforcement and to public safety. And so to do that, I had to get a kind of permission from the gang guys and the ex-gang guys and the intervention experts and the women who are gang intervention experts. I had to get permission. And I said, here's what you're going to see. I was just very transparent. I said, you're going to see me talking to this deputy chief. You're going to see me talking to this commander. I said, here's what I'm going to say to them. You know, I'm not revealing any secrets, and vice versa. You know, I said, the cops, I had to tell the cops, you know, I have to keep in contact with the people who control the violence on the streets. And you need to get in your bullheads, you know, that you also need to be able to talk to everybody in the community, including the gangsters. So it was that shuttle diplomacy and that outreach that we had to do. And what they couldn't understand is that the police are the real power. I mean, the book is called Power Concedes Nothing. I'm very good at figuring out who really holds the power in a system.
Right.
And I had to tell the gang members, I said, I don't care how noble you're living your lives and how nobly you're living your lives right now. You are former gangsters. You are not going to persuade judges or politicians or cops to do anything. But if the cops say that the strategies of going into these communities and really serving them and protecting them as opposed to targeting them, if the cops say they want to change, you'll see an incredible turnaround. And we did. Once the cops decided to trust our vision and Bratton decided to back us, and then after Bratton, Charlie Beck, who's the current LAPD chief, we really had something, because when LAPD stands up and tells the politicians we're doing this, whether you like it or not, it's not just some lone civil rights lawyer they can ignore. It's LAPD. So I kind of do jujitsu. You kind of hijack the power of your opponent, and you ride shotgun with them, and you get them to argue for what you need.
That power, however, I would assume can switch on a dime, can it? I mean, this is all a house of cards.
Yes, it is, but it's sure a whole lot better than just doing warfare in court and hand-to-hand combat on the streets. And, you know, that's been old for 50 years. So we needed a game changer, and it may not last, but right now, because of this huge report we wrote, and write about this in the book too, when I stopped suing, I said, okay, what other levers do I have? And then sometimes if you write a big report, it can galvanize a political change. And so we wrote this huge report that answered the question, why is LA stuck on stupid when it comes to gangs? And the police backed this report. And this report said, we're doing all the wrong things. Mass incarceration just makes them more vicious when they come out. We're not rehabilitating them. We're not keeping the next generation of kids from joining the gangs. We're not fighting the cult of death and how attractive that's made to kids who think they have no future. And so we had to change focus, and we did it on the basis of this big report that changed the political discussion. And when Chief Bratton told a whole bunch of city council people, no, I'm backing Connie, Connie's right on this, then they had to change how they fought gangs. And lo and behold, we started doing wraparound strategies, keep the whole ecosystem safer for the kids, and the community realizes they can afford to say no to a gang. Because everybody's there pitching in and rowing in the same boat, and everybody's visible. And so summer night lights, you keep the parks open to 1 o'clock in the morning. And you want to know what happened once we started doing these epidemiological kind of public health wraparound strategies as opposed to lock them up and, you know, whack-a-mole kind of strategies, or just locking up the same people over and over and over again.
Right.
When we moved to the ecosystem keep all the kids safe strategies, we found that in the areas around the Summer Night Lights project, the gang homicides plummeted 57%.
Wow.
57%. LAPD had never seen anything like it. And the reason that it was is because the gang members weren't trying to kill people and do drive-bys. They were in the park playing chess. They were in the park doing swim team. You know, we just gave the community a whole bunch of healthy, positive alternatives. And when you give the community a choice between body bags and vital programs that keep going till 2 o'clock in the morning, they're going to choose the latter every time. And so the power of the grassroots community started pushing back the gang control of that neighborhood. And guess what? If parents who finally saw their kids outside because it was now safe enough for their kids to go to the park and participate in the activities, guess what? They all of a sudden started talking to the gang members, and the gang members started respecting what the grandmothers and the mothers and the fathers were saying, and they backed off. So, yeah, is it hanging by a thread? Oh, yeah. You know, I'm surprised that, oh, yeah, and we could be back at war any time. But, you know, I want to know something. The point of this book is showing people how we've taken the private sector, the faith-based sector, the schools, the cops, and the other government agencies, melded them into an army to make these hot zones safe. So it's not about no government, too big government. That's a stupid conversation. It's about making government operate with these other sectors in an effective way with the right policy. And people may wonder, what is she doing running around with a bunch of gangsters? Well, as a civil rights lawyer, what's the first civil right? The first of all civil rights is the right to safety.
Right.
Because if you're not safe and you don't have the first of all freedoms, which is freedom from violence, you don't have anything. All your other rights don't mean a thing. And that's what we've been doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so what General McChrystal, the reason he endorsed this book is because he was basically saying, you're doing what we had to do in Afghanistan, and we need it even more here.
The name of the book is Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Battle for Social Justice in America, From the Kill Zones to the Courtroom. The book is published by Scribner. Connie Rice, a great pleasure to have you share your thoughts with us this morning. I appreciate you being here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the book is Power Concedes Nothing. It is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.